Welcome to the Bull Simons Op Center Podcast, where warriors share their stories about key events in military history. Arthur D. Bull Simons was a legendary Special Forces soldier who is famous for leading the Son Tay raid into North Vietnam in November 1970 to rescue American POWs. The Bull Simons Op Center is a program of the nonprofit Simons Center for Ethical Leadership and Interagency Cooperation on Fort Leavenworth, Kansas.
All right, today we got a special guest. We're joined with Brigadier General Stan Cherry, U.S. Army retired. General Cherry was an armor officer and an Army pilot. Two tours in Vietnam, Desert Storm, Bosnia, a successful 34-year Army career. General Cherry, thanks for joining us here on the Bull Simons podcast. Really looking forward to talking about your life and your successful career in the Army. At this point, looking back on everything, what kind of things come to mind with such a successful career in the Army and a lot of years of reflection behind us now?
Well, I've been asked that before, and I kind of go all the way back to in college and deciding what I wanted to do. And I always, as a kid, hoped to be a professional baseball player, and that's just I was based on baseball and that. And I had several tryouts or whatever, but when I got to college, I had trouble in college. I was going to be a doctor, so I really overloaded trying to play two sports or whatever. So ROTC became critically important, and I wanted to learn how to fly. I always had this thing, baseball and flying, if you look at some of my Cub Scout books, whatever, my mother kept it. There was always airplanes in there strafing submarines and things. And so I ROTC gave me that chance perhaps be a pilot. And I knew I was going to go in. I was happy to be an armor officer. But I always really thought it was going to didn't think of a military career. It was like I was going to do my service 3 or 4 years. Learn to fly and then take it from there. But going back to Southern New Jersey, being just like my algebra teacher, Bob, who played football for Villanova, I wanted to be a high school football coach and teach general science and be a helicopter pilot, and I'd be happy as a clam. And that's pretty much the way it worked out until I got out of basic and I went to Fort Lewis I got assigned as a reconnaissance platoon leader in the 1st Squadron, 10th Cav. 50 soldiers, 48 or 49 soldiers, three tanks, a mortar, an infantry squad, an engineer squad, my own little army. And the hook was set in. Whoa, put all that other stuff on hold. This army stuff, they're buying the fuel or letting me drive the tanks. I fell in love with the Army, and that was it. And I was absolutely hooked from then on. There were some high points and low points, but that's when I made the career decision as a second lieutenant that I was in for the long haul.
Amazing. Now, coming out of college at Rutgers ROTC, you were commissioned second lieutenant as an armor officer.
Yes, sir. Yep. And went through basic airborne, and then there was a Ranger School loot there, and I really wanted to go to Ranger School, but that was going to push a couple of months and maybe more of going to flight school, because I had to serve a year on the ground, and I wanted my year to start as soon as I clocked in. So I wish I had gone to Ranger School, tried to become a Ranger, but My main goal is get that out of the way, start serving, and so I could start the clock to get into flight school. And I was worried about Vietnam was going to end before I had a chance to get there and do my part. Little did I know, you know.
But, no kidding. So it was already set in motion coming out of college that you were eventually going to go to flight school.
I had taken ROTC flight, and I learned how to fly a little old fixed wing, and I had taken the fast test and everything, and I started, you had to be on active duty to be able to apply for it. So as soon as I got to Fort Lewis, I applied for flight school, and that's what started the clock for 1 year on the ground first.
And then So shortly after that, when was your first tour in Vietnam?
My first tour, I came right out of flight school. We graduated in the 6th December 1966. About 90% of us, closer to 95% got orders to Vietnam. My orders were to go to the 191st Assault Helicopter Company, which wasn't even there yet. It was a company forming at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. So I left from Fort Rucker, stopped in and signed in, and they wanted me to stay over Christmas there since I was a first or second officer signed in. And I said, nothing doing. I got some leads here. But we formed a company in Fort Bragg, North Carolina. We had a sister company forming in Fort Hood, and we both arrived in Vietnam about May of 1966. I knew that I was going to be part of this crew, the 191st. We formed a brand new company. If you've never done that before, there's a lot of fits and starts there, but we had several of, I guess about 20 of my flight school companions were in that class. So that made it good. But we had a lot of rookies. And when we went to Vietnam, we weren't infused. Normally, they take a new company like that, and they put a tremendous amount of veterans in it. We were about 50-50, and that was really a high rate of rookies. So as you might imagine, we had our problems with accidents and things like that. But I got to Vietnam as part of the 191st in May of 1967. I was assigned as a part of the gunship platoon. We had two lift platoons flying Delta model Hueys. And we were flying Bravo model gunships that had the four machine guns and two seven-shot rocket pods. I was assigned as a section leader, which meant four helicopters, four crews, and we had a platoon leader and two section leaders. And we stayed there until December. We were late getting our helicopters, but we got some good training in. We then flew our helicopters across country to can't remember what it was, near San Francisco, and put them on a ship, and then all rallied after leave and met back in a place called Bearcat, which is northeast of Saigon, the headquarters of the 9th Division there. We were two new companies that would be in support of the 9th Infantry Division in 1967.
Yeah. Wow. Now, just out of curiosity, how much flying experience or flight hours, that kind of thing, did you guys have, or most of you have, right out of flight school? Because it happened pretty quick out of flight school.
200 hours. that was, I mean, and we were all rookies, and then none of us had white hair in our sideburns and all. We were rookies, and we were pretty good. We didn't have many accidents or incidents when we acted as a company, when we were the escorts, the gunships or escorts. But when we did what was called ash and trash, and we went to different places with two ships in one place or whatever, as you can imagine, a bunch of rookies flying helicopters with 200 hours under our belt. We had a lot of stupid accidents, you know, hitting tail rotors, things like that. It was a good company. We had good leadership. Major Patnode, who had been our gun platoon leader, became our company commander as soon as we got to Vietnam. And that was, everybody liked him. He was a good leader. So we had a good shot in the arm there. Many of our people that were in our flight school class were in the other company that formed at Fort Hood. So we had a large portion of our flight school class that went through both Fort Walters and Fort Rucker, in the same concern, if you will, the same base camp at Bearcat. So that made for good camaraderie, if you will.
Yeah. And describe some of the significant events that happened in your first tour of Vietnam.
Well, the first real fight I can, you know, we had a couple of fights, you know, get shot at here and there, or whatever, especially when you're out on the single ship missions of supporting the Australians or the Navy. But I can remember it was 10 August that's when it came clear to me that there were people there that were trying to kill you. There's no doubt about that. I had about 6 or 8 holes in the ship, but most of the time they were in the rotor or the tail boom. These 2 or 3 of them were in the cockpit, so that got my attention. I had to fill out. I didn't realize the legion of forms you have to fill out, and I did that, and I got back to the hooch and the little the phone rings, a little 312, and you got a message from the Red Cross. Oh, as you know, as a service member, you get a Red Cross message, it's bad. Mm-hmm. So I went over there. He was on his supper break, so I had to wait another hour. My wife was pregnant when I left, but I thought the due date was September. But the due date just happened to be 10 August. That's why I remember 10 August, because it's a first day I got my butt shot off, and my son was born that day. So I became a dad, I can still remember the feeling. Oh my God, I'm a father now. But I didn't get to see my son. They didn't let you go home or anything like that. Then he was 9 months old when I got home. After that, we would do the normal inserting troops with the 9th Division. The gunships were escorts and would prepare the L landing zone. But we had two major incidents that I can really remember. One was in a couple of weeks before Tet. And what I learned later, the Viet Cong all across the country were trying to stage larger unit contacts away from major cities, because when Tet hit, they were going to be in the major cities. But nobody really picked up on that. But we put a 150 or so RFPF, regional force, popular force, into an area northeast of Saigon, northeast of where we were in Bear Cat. Out near a big mountain called Gia Ray. And we put them in on a gravel strip between two huge rice paddies. And then we went away, went about our business as gunships. We had another mission, and then we were coming back to pick them up at about 1700. We refueled at a place called Black Horse. That's where the 11th ACR was at the time. And we got on the nozzles after the slicks took off. They had just taken off, and we put about 5 minutes worth of gas in it and then took off. And we were catching up to the slicks, 4 gunships, 2 on it would be on either side. And we're going to land on this gravel road that went through about 600 yards of rice paddy. It was a dry season then. Right down the middle of that. And as we were coming in, the slicks were just ready to touch down. And as you call, you got on each side of the road, you would have like 5 Vietnamese on one side and 5 on another. We were in trail formation, one ship behind the other, coming in, 10 ships laying down on this. And they would lay down and 5 would load from one side and 5 for the other side. Just as they were about 100 feet, in altitude, slowing down to the east, was a wood line about 300 meters from the road. Estimate about 300 Viet Cong broke out of that wood line. These people that we were picking up had just come out of that wood line. So these 300 people were following these people after they had gone to their depth of the operation, came out of spider holes or whatever.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, this day, my ship had 19 rockets on either side and a 40 millimeter on the nose. This day, the platoon leader, Major Bob Stack, probably the best pilot I ever saw, he said, "Stan, I want to sit right seat with you today, if that's okay." I said, "Sure, you're the boss." And I was on the 40 millimeter. You can imagine we're coming in, and the slicks were just about to touch down, and they just rolled it over and took off. One got his had an RPG through the tail. It didn't explode, but it cut the tail rotor wires, and he augured in. Another one had his part of his engine shot out, so he landed. So we have two ships down. All these RFPFs have weapons and everything, so they're firing at these people charging across. They were trying to get the helicopters, what they were doing. Mm-hmm. But suddenly I'm in the left seat, and I got 400 rounds of 40 millimeter, and I didn't know who to shoot first, you know, and it was almost carnage. Wow. Bottom line is we killed 274 or 5 of them in about 15 minutes. And broke that up, and they went back. We called airstrikes and whatever. We lost no people. We had two ships down. They had to be back by Shook after that. We had a lot of holes in the ships, but nobody got hurt.
Yeah, that's great.
But we weren't able to put that together. Why all of a sudden this happened? We had never seen a human wave attack before. Huh. Before that, and that was one of the ones that. Was absolutely significant, strangely enough, we all went back on it, and I had counter mortar that night. One of two ships were on counter mortar, right out with the blades untied, ready to go. You could jump in and get it started and be on the air about less than 10 minutes. Everybody, there was so much adrenaline flowing that about half the company. Or half the pilots were about midnight, were throwing up and diarrhea, whatever. Really? All that adrenaline pumped in there, and nobody got hurt. And then you started thinking about it. So that was the first real, my introduction to nose combat. And if I never saw that again, that would be okay. And we had one other one that I was involved in a little later on. The first part of Tet, everybody was going into Saigon or whatever, and I got assigned to go to support the Australians at their base camp. And normally what we do, we go in, refuel, park the helicopter, go to the mess, and they have the coffee and cooking or whatever, and that would be where we wait. We get our mission briefing. We were met on the tarmac by the refuel, and they said they had a tactical E in a place called Berea, town of about maybe 20,000, a pretty decent sized metropolis, and it's deep in Three Corps in Vietnam, and that's the southeast of Saigon by about 40 miles, I guess. They had an armored cavalry troop that had been hit. With an ambush, one of the tracks was burning. They had this severely injured people, but they couldn't get into them because there was a 50 caliber on top of this, what I thought was a schoolhouse. Later we found out it was a theater, and he had an American 50 caliber because the tracers were pink, like mm-hmm. pink golf balls as opposed to green. The Soviet 50 caliber. So we went out there, got briefed on the way, you know, when I'm sure you know, but if you're a helicopter pilot, you really know 50 caliber means you don't go anywhere near it in a little titanium plastic helicopter. Yep. Or plexiglass, not plastic. But anyway, the track, we could see the track was burning and whatever. When we saw where the 50 caliber was, and he saw where we were and started firing at us, so we got backed off on that. I told my wingman I wanted him to go around, and it was to the north, and the wind was blowing out of the north. The track was burning, and it just all like an oil fire going up. I told my wingman, Larry Miller, CW2, go out there and play around with him, but don't get within the, don't let him knock you out of the air, but get his attention. And I'm going to go into the smoke plume, and come down the smoke plume till I can get where I was qualified to be able to kill a guy. So we did that. I climbed up to about 2,500 feet. he's out there, and he definitely had the attention of this guy. And I entered the smoke plume, and I'm coming down. And when I hit 1,500 feet, I broke out, leveled out, and put the pipper on this building, the top of the building. That's how finite it was. It's none of this. You see the hellfire, and it's right there, and that's exactly where it goes. When you punch that rocket off, if you're not in trim or whatever, you don't know where the hell it's going to land. You know about where it's going to land.
Right.
So I punched the trigger or the pipper three times, 1, 2, 3. So that's 6 rockets in there. And then I got down as low as I could, and I didn't see any tracers coming at me, but I didn't look very hard. I was just making sure I didn't pull the rotor head off. And all I heard my wingman say was, "Way to go, boss, way to go." what happened is suddenly the Australians had told us this, the guy just disappeared. The 50 caliber just disappeared. Later, I got pictures from an Australian friend of mine who I met in the British Staff College. He was the commander of that unit. I didn't find that out for 20 years later. But one of the rockets did not point detonate when it hit the building. It went through and hit the back of the building, and that was about 10 feet underneath where this 50 caliber was. And when it hit the back wall, it blew up and the thing caved in. And I didn't get a chance to put a rocket in this guy's helmet, but he probably got buried in plaster or whatever. So
I wonder if it went through a window or a door.
No, it went right through. You can see the where the other rockets had hit. There's about a 10-foot hole where the 10-pound warhead just blew the wall apart. And this is a hole about the size of a softball, and that's where it went straight through. Did not point detonate the first time, but when it hit the back wall, it detonated. And 10 pounds of TNT. And we were just lucky on that one. During the Tet Offensive, there were multiple big punch-ups like that. We really didn't know what was going on, but we knew that they would stand and fight us, and they didn't give a rat's about casualties at all. And we had a pretty high rate. We lost 5 pilots and 6 crew chiefs. Mm-hmm. Or door gunners, and that's just out of our platoon in a year. And in my year, I got 1,485 hours, and that's that's almost a career in Army aviation now. And we were flying a lot, and it's really a young man's game too. I found out later on. And,
absolutely, yeah. So
when we left there. I left in May of we had a second Tet Offensive just before I left, we were still doing well. Our measure of success was how many of them we were killing, but things looked good. We were going doing okay, and I think most of us felt when we derosed between May and June of that 1968. And we came home to a real mess. People didn't, we were almost treated. I wasn't personally, not at that point. I did have people spit at me in uniform, but it definitely wasn't like Desert Storm. We were, the military was definitely unpopular, if you will. And we were just doing what we were told, you know.
Right. So I imagine that was a bit of a culture shock after a year in Vietnam and your first combat experience, numerous ones, also having your first child, your son, and you come back and try to adjust to that.
I went back to the career course, and about 95% of us had just come back from Vietnam. So we had a good chance to compare experiences. But one thing that was true for everybody, we knew we weren't liked very much as a military and couldn't understand it. We were just a bunch of young kids doing what the hell we were told, you know,
right.
and we were pretty proud of we were following orders, and by the measures that were put in front of us, we were using the weaponry. We weren't a bunch of people going out trying to kill people or whatever, and we're pretty careful about doing that, about being ethical in what we were doing. Joe, I'll just tell you, the people that I was in combat with, that I flew with, are still the people today. I mean, as a staff officer in Seventh Corps or whatever, I was part of I was a staff puke. And in Bosnia, I had good friends there. But when you've been in combat like that and people are depending on you for their life, you know, that's something that you know it and having been there. But people, you can't put a measure on that. It's just a certain feeling that only we have, you know. And I'm glad I have it.
And, absolutely. Yeah. So how long were you back in the States before you went back for your second tour?
I came out of I was back I was almost 2 years. That was 68. I came back 3 years. I didn't go back until 71. I had the career course. I went to Germany and have my second cavalry assignment on the border with the 14th Cav. I was a troop commander. Then I came back to advanced flight training, fixed wing, bird dog, twin engine. I mean, just, you know, okay. I mean, I was on the track to be a senior aviator. I really kind of liked the armor part of it better, but I was being groomed. I could go either way, the aviation command or a ground tactical command.
Right.
And I got orders after advanced flight training to go back to Vietnam in late February in 1971. And I had a port call, and then my port call was changed, and things started. All of this was a function of Vietnam was shutting down, and the change was daily life in 1971 for sure.
Mm. And were you flying again? Were you also flying in your second tour in 71?
Well, I went back as an aviator and said, you know, I'd like to get in the 11th ACR. And I said, no, they're going home, son. Can't do that. But I was looking to Cobras were coming in. So there weren't a whole lot of Huey gunships. I knew I wouldn't get a fixed wing assignment because that was those were all flight detachments and twin engine. That was senior warrant officers, whatever. So I didn't really know what was in the cards for me, but I was in the AmeriCal in July combat introduction center. And I got a note that hand delivered to me that this brigade commander invited me to dinner, and it's just like China Beach, you know. they had tables and looked right out on the beach, and I mean silverware and china tables, and had his whole staff in there. And I, ooh. So after dinner, we went in the back, and he had my 201 file, and he says, "I see you commanded a armored cav troop in Vietnam." He says, "I need an armored cav troop." He said, "We had a lot of problems with this." It was a separate brigade cav troop, is what it was. About 150 people, and boy, that sounded that command. But he sweetened it by saying, "I will make sure that you get Cobra transition after 6 months, and get Cobra transition, and then I will come back for a short tour flying Cobras." And man, that just sounded like nothing was better than that. So I got assigned to 8th Troop, 17th Cav in the AmeriCal division. And you remember who was in that division? That was the AmeriCali division. And the distaste and the stink of the My Lai incident is still hung over there. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure about every place in Vietnam, but anytime you're ready to leave something, I remember General Cavazos, when we were telling him we were going to have a refuel on the move with 7th Corps, you can't stop a large unit once you take a breath. Once you get that feeling, you never get it moving again. And he was right. I never saw anything as disorganized as trying to check into the 11th, into the AmeriCal division. But I got into my troop, and I showed up in a bunch of Quonset huts they had there. We had Sheridans, the light tank, if you will, and 113s. And I went in, and my first sergeant was John Stevens. who went on to be a four-star sergeant major. He was went on to be the 11th ACR sergeant major. We're still good friends now. Mm-hmm. And in my end brief, he said, I want to give you three words. He said, drugs, drugs, and drugs. Mm. And I would say that out of 150, I probably had 120 strength. I would say 25 to 30% were, if not addicted to heroin, strong users of heroin, and that was the drug of choice then. You could get a thimble, your wife's little thimble with a lid on it, little plastic thing, not as big as an earplug container, about half of that size.
Yeah.
And that would cost $4, and that's about 90% pure heroin. And he said, we got a real problem, boss. Our maintenance, there's no parts. We got the motor off. The motor NCO sits outside the scavenger yard. When one gets hit, they go in and cannibalize it, whatever. So I realized, in addition to the mission that we would have, I got another mission of trying to institute the rule of law with people that were abusing drugs so big time. And I found out that I had some pretty good NCOs, but most of the non-commissioned officers were the shake and bake 90-day wonders. But I had two of my platoons had E7s as platoon leaders. So we didn't have a full complement of officers. But I was in the 2nd Brigade, and we were conducting either search and destroy missions, looking for supplies. Then later on, we formed a provisional cavalry squadron with three cav troops, a small headquarters, commanded by Fred Wilmuth, W-I-L-M-U-T-H, and he had played tackle at Army. Great big redheaded guy. And we were west of Da Nang. And what we were doing was setting up screens there. And it was our job. We were almost like tripwire to, oh, here comes a big force, because we didn't have the firepower to do any more than the screen. Look, report, and follow up. Interesting, never really got into a fight with the cavalry troop. I was only there from February through May. Never got in a place where they stood and fought us. But I would say 90% of the nights, as soon as the sun went down, we got mortared. I mean, they were there. They knew where we were. On two occasions, on one occasion, we were west of Da Nang. I had just given the midnight sit rep, and Dagger 3 is I can't remember call sign, negative sit rep. So then all of a sudden, as soon as I said that, small mortars started landing within the perimeter. Perimeter is about not quite as big as a football field for a cav troop, maybe two-thirds of a football field. Big as an infield, a major league infield, if you go to a ballpark where the infield touches the grass, that's about the size of a circle. Your mortars in the center going, covering you, whatever. So mortar rounds started firing in, and all of a sudden a huge explosion. Grabbed my helmet, my radio operator and I came out across the perimeter. One of the tracks was on fire. Went over to say, and there was a guy just on the back deck, got him out of there, whatever. The track just burned all night, and we took roll call. We were missing one person, and we had a Rough Puff Company RFPF assigned with us, and there was a huge hole right next to the track, and it looked like something like a huge bomb. It couldn't have been just a little IED. It was so I I thought it was maybe an airplane coming back from a bombing run had pickled one off inadvertently or whatever, mm-hmm. and dropped it, and it just happened to land there or whatever. We took roll. We had one sergeant missing. We found him. He had been sleeping on the back deck of the Sheridan, and when the mortars came in, he obviously had sat up, and a piece of shrapnel came and just hit him in the side of the head, and he fell back in his sleeping bag. So we lost one American and eight RFPFs that were proximal to where this huge hole. We had the EOD folks came out, and they found the base plate of a 250-pound American bomb in there. So it was a bomb. So, you know, you wouldn't think that they would bury a bomb a 250-pound bomb, because how would they know where it was, and how would they command detonate it? We had no idea. So about less than a week later, again at night, we're in a different place, maybe within 5 miles of this place. And when you have an RFPF unit with you, you have to be near a river or some source of water, because they don't carry their own water. They just have a little canteen, and you have to. And we certainly didn't have a water buffalo with us. But anyway, we get the same thing. Boom, boom, boom. It's a little 60-millimeter mortar. Got a sit rep, accountability check, everything. And I get this call, six, this is 2-1, Sergeant Moy. He says, you're not going to believe this. He said, but I got a torpedo laying next to my Sheridan. And I said, a torpedo? We're 40 miles inland, for Christ's sake. You know? He said, sir, I said, okay. I knew where the second platoon was. So I go out there, and I got my red filter flashlight, and I get up to Sergeant Moy's tank, and he's pointing in this dark. And, you know, somebody asked me once, one of the students here, sir, how much nighttime flying did you get? I said, about 600 hours. He said, how much of that was under goggles? I said, son, goggles weren't invented yet. Yeah. So when it got dark, so he pointed down, and I look at this thing, and I go to the left to right, and it looks like a torpedo, but it's a 250-pound bomb laying there about 10 feet from the Sheridan. And coming out the bottom end of it, like two wires, and there's wires coming out of the other end. So I said, I didn't know what the hell to do. So I said, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to leave the RPG screens that we had in front of this cyclone fence we put up with engineer stakes, and everybody just back out. And we had already reconned another area, an alternate night defensive position. And we're going to just ooze out of there, because I don't know whether this is going to go off or not. And we did, and we relocated, and we went back. As most units on the ground had, you had a reformed VC with you, and you were paying him. And he became your KC, Kansas City Scout, KC Scout, they called him. And he drew a little thing on a piece of cardboard, and he drew it like in up in the air and around and around and around like that. What these guys would do when they would find these unexploded ordnance things, they would put these things, bury these two things, just bury in a small, just enough to cover the top of the bomb, and they cover that with palm fronds, and they put a small tamping charge in it that would blow this thing and throw it into what was considered to be a night. The Viet Cong knew exactly what we needed. They could pick a night defensive position as well as we could. So we called it the lob bomb, and I wrote an article about it and put it in Vietnam about the lob bombs. I did it the first time. That's what it was when it landed. And the second time it came into our perimeter, it didn't go off. So that was a terror weapon. So for the remainder of that tour of us out there, we would go into a position and get all set up. And then after we stayed there about 2 hours, we'd back out and go to another night defensive position. And they may not have seen us. We didn't put up all our night stakes and all that kind of stuff. It was just a temporary thing to get in, get out, let the people know we were there, and then go someplace else. But I had my eyes open, was definitely worried about it. People wanted to quit. They boss, we got to get the hell out of here. It was a terror weapon, and it wreaked terror with the 80 or so people I had in the field with me at that time.
Wow, no kidding. Well, General Cherry, hold that thought. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back.
Okay, fair enough.
The U.S. Army Commander General Staff College on Fort Leavenworth celebrates its 140th anniversary in 2021. It was founded by General William Tecumseh Sherman in 1881 as the School for the Application of Cavalry and Infantry. The CGSC Foundation supports the development of leaders of character and competence at the college for ethical service to the nation in three general areas: scholarship, outreach, and soldiers and family support. You can contribute to the Margin of Excellence by making a tax-exempt contribution through our website at cgscf.org/donate. That's cgscf.org/donate. All right, back talking with Brigadier General Stan Cherry. So, all right, sir, you were talking about the lob bomb. I had a question about that. Just to make sure I understood this correct, because I don't think I've ever heard this. But if they found some unexploded ordnance, like an American bomb, they figured out how to place it next to a place where American troops might decide to hunker down for the night.
Mm-hmm.
And they would put some kind of detonation charge underneath the bomb just to lob it over into the open area where you might be, and hopefully it might detonate when it lands in the middle of you guys. Is that really what they were doing?
That's exactly what they were doing. And wow. and that type of ordnance was around. I had gone through a village that had an airstrike, and there must have been at least six bombs that looked like 250-pound palm trees. Just like with the big fins on the back, and they're stuck in the ground, and they could get those things out, take the pet them out of the inside for IED manufacture or whatever. But to the best, and this is only from former Viet Cong diagramming on the back of a piece of cardboard, how they would do this, and they would select a place to put it proximal to a night defensive position. And why they wanted to lob it in and they just didn't command detonate it, I don't know. but that was the case. And it's really had no scientific proof other than this guy. And I know our troop was subjected to at least two of them in that 1 week period.
Yeah. That's crazy. You did have an unfortunate injury in Vietnam for the end of your second tour.
I did, and it followed very close by these lob bomb incidents. We went back to Chu Lai for about a maintenance stand down for 3 or 4 days, and then we deployed up near it's called the Batangan Peninsula. That's pretty close to where My Lai was, and we were in an area. We were actually searching for bunkers, looking for weapons. As I said, contact with the enemy was very, very sparse. We found a bunker complex. Reformed VC scout looked at all the bunkers. They found a one that had a grenade in it, and we defused the grenade. We had a new lieutenant, and I was showing this lieutenant how to ruin a bunker. And the way we do it, we wouldn't blow the lid off the top of a bunker. We put a charge in the bunker and just break the roof log bases and have it cave in, because it's almost easier to build another bunker than it is to re-excavate that. And mm-hmm. We learned that from the Viet Cong also. So I had 3 sticks of C4 that I had put together with a charge and crawled in into the bunker and showed this lieutenant exactly where to put it. I crawled back out of the bunker, and the last thing I remember, both the tracks, my track and another Sharon, were within 10 feet of the bunker. So I backed them up, gave them hands it back up. I looked at my track commander, Ed Vinay, and I'm telling him to back up like that. Got him backed up, told him to stop, and I turned around and looked at the bunker, and I must have stepped on the side of the bunker, because we had cleared all the bunker area, And best that I can think, reconstructed by my driver and my first sergeant, later in the hospital, they told me, it was on the side of the bunker, a hole about as big as you could put two basketballs in. And I tripped, we used to call it booby trap. I tripped that, and it just, the blast blew me about, it didn't blow me up in the air, blew me laterally about 20 feet. I knew my, the real pain was in my right hand, felt like it was on fire, and my left foot felt like it was on fire, and I could see bones out of my right boot. So basically I lost the front part of my right foot, but my right heel was severely damaged. My right hand was kind of mangled. I was missing the last two fingers, and the left heel of my boot was completely blown off, and my heel pad was completely blown off. So I had three significant wounds. I was in a Huey within 15-20 minutes. Went into Duckfo, a med station, and they cut my fatigues off or whatever, and they put me on a chopper and sent me to Chu Lai.
So was that a landmine?
It was a landmine and probably all blast, the stuff out of these bombs that I was telling you, mm-hmm. a very high explosive, because I had no shrapnel. No shrapnel or nails or anything like that, just blasts. After July, I was sent to Camp Zama, Japan. I was the exception to the rule because I had a lot of infection. Normally, you spend 3 or 4 days in Zama. I was there about 6.5 weeks, a lot of skin grafts and infection. They had to take my right foot off at the ankle because my heel became necrotic. So I left Japan to come back to Valley Forge General Hospital with a severely damaged hand, my right foot off at the ankle, and my left heel had a skin graft on it, but my left heel was completely blown away. And that's what it was when I landed at McGuire, and then from McGuire the next night, my wife and my mother came to see me about 4 o'clock in the morning. And I was on a Huey headed to Valley Forge General Hospital, mm-hmm. Up in the northwest of Philadelphia. And it's that hospital has been there for Second World War, Korea, and Vietnam. And I was there about 16 months total.
Wow. No kidding. Yep. Can you talk a little bit about how you were? I mean, that was fairly early on in your career. How did you finish 34 years in the Army with missing, not just missing a foot, but severely damaged hand and your other heel?
Well, I was a captain, and I had my guide on, red and white guide on there, and this guy came in and talked to me. The ward master told me I had a guest, and he's about mid-height, about 5'8", 5'9", mustache, and very friendly. I thought he worked at a library because he's going to get me some graduate record books because I didn't have a master's. And when he left, I turned to my Spec 4 buddy in the next bed. I said, "Who was this?" "Oh, that's Major Fred Franks." And he came in here with his left foot all damaged or whatever, and it wouldn't heal. And he said, "Cut it off, because I got to get back to the cavalry, and he's gonna go back to the 3rd Cav." Well, I had no idea what a one-legged armor officer was going to do, but this guy was a one-legged armor officer, and he said, and I didn't know he was in the Army because he had a mustache. And in those days, nobody in the Army had a mustache except Fred Franks. And how he did that, I don't know, but... anyway, that started me writing to all the people I knew, trying to get see if they'd vouch for me back on active duty. Mm-hmm. A couple were reticent about doing it, but they did it because they didn't want me to get to a certain point in my career where suddenly I'd be, you know, I wouldn't get something that I may have earned, but because of my injuries, I couldn't do it. So, I didn't have any problems. I really only had one person in the remainder of my career. I was set to take over a squadron XO, and he didn't think that I had the physical capability to do it. And anyway,
really?
It worked out.
Yep. Yeah, no kidding. No kidding. Well, sir, we are getting close to the end of our time, but I do want to give you a chance to, I mean, you had a phenomenal experiences in Vietnam, but we've only just barely made it out of Vietnam at this point, and you still had a number of other phenomenal things in your 34-year career.
Well, I got a call. I was in the brigade command up at Grosset, 2nd AD forward, and from my old tactics director, John Landry, and he said, "Hey, General Franks is wants you to become the G3 after Shinseki," and I couldn't believe it, but that happened. I went down and right seated with Rick Shinseki, who was a good friend. We were getting ready for a warfighter and a core warfighter, and we did that. And during the warfighter, that's when in August, that's when Saddam rolled into Kuwait, we set up a headquarters to monitor what was going on down there, just as a professional development thing, and we had that in the basement of Stuttgart. And it was the 2nd of October. General Franks called me down to his office, and he's talking, I think, to General Vono, and he writes on a little 3x5 card, VII Corps Mission MSN, destroy RGSC. So I looked at him and said, "You and me, we're going to fly." And he goes like mm-hmm. that. And I thought, oh, God, that was my wife's birthday and our anniversary on the 2nd of October. How the hell am I going to get to dinner tonight with this news breaking now? I was more worried about that than getting the Corps from Germany into Saudi Arabia. We started. It was top secret speak at. Only about a half a dozen of us knew it. We flew down there for recon, came back. How we were notified, we were told by the Pentagon, it was November, watch CNN tonight. And that's how we were notified that we were going. And that was on the 10th of November. Getting the Corps there was one of the hardest things I've ever done. We took 42 days, 437 air missions, 105 ships, 19,500 wheels. So it's a big job getting there, and then getting up country. We had to move 500 kilometers up country to get to the fight, and they all had to be moved by head. So that there's some significant things that aren't battle related, but are definitely you got to take care of it as a corps commander. And then the only thing, it was a standard fight. General Franks and I, we knew each other from several assignments we had together, 2 years in the regiment, a year and a half here at CGSC. He wanted to stay on and be his chief, but I couldn't do it. I knew him very, very well, so I knew what he wanted. He didn't have to explain it, and that's good. So all I did was monitor the fight, and execute orders that he wanted me to pass to people. Mm-hmm. People trusted me. They knew the relationship I had with the boss, so the division commanders trusted me as an 06. The last day of the last night of the war, there was some confusion there. The mission I got was stop people from going through this road junction, and I got it from General Arnold, who I think was the MVP of Desert Storm. And we did that with helicopters or whatever, and that somehow got mixed up. And because when the war stopped, where General Schwarzkopf thought the forces were and where we were weren't the same. And we had to go and kick them off the place that he had told the chairman that we were going to have the peace treaty. General Franks thought he was going to get relieved, but we didn't do anything wrong. It was just not a reporting error, but we were not where our map and his map and his headquarters were not the same. Anyway, that all went away. But I'll tell you, fighting the fight was a hell of a lot easier than getting the Corps there and getting the Corps up country. That was the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. But we did a pretty good job. I've taken General Frank's slot. He said, "I'm getting too old to do it." He passed the mantle off to me to talk to the entire class about large unit operations. And I give them 2 hours of Desert Storm, 7th Corps and Desert Storm, an hour and 15 minutes chat about the fight, getting there and the fight, and another hour just answering questions, which are great.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah.
And I thought that was just about a career. I was done. I came back to retire. General Franks got me a job as the director of tactics, and I've been through one full class. I got a call from General Franks telling me this Wednesday afternoon that I got to be, General Sullivan wants me back in Germany on Sunday morning. We got a jet flight and all that, but this is Wednesday. I'm in Kansas. He told me, call this guy and he'll give you tickets. And I called and they said, General Officer Management. And he told me it was going to be a G3 and a brand new multinational corps that they were putting together. He didn't tell me I was going to be a general officer. So that was a big surprise. So I had two wonderful years with the ARC, Allied Command Europe Rapid Reaction Corps, and they were going to be our headquarters in Bosnia. And I remember coming home after serving with the ARC, and I told Mariana, we're going back to the 1st Armored Division, old Ironside. She said, thank God you won't have to go to Bosnia. I said, not so fast, Pancho, because I knew the 1st Armored Division was going to be the division that was going to be subordinate to the ARC as the American forces in Bosnia.
Wow, that's amazing. Well, sir, we are pretty much done here at this point. But, just looking back, reflecting on a successful Army career, 34 years worth, what kind of thoughts come to mind? And if you're talking to some of those young majors at Command General Staff College.
I will tell you, all the family separation you really don't appreciate that until you look back and you have a chance to talk to your wife about it and you talk to your kids. But I've asked my children about it. Would you be, they said they wouldn't trade me an Army brat for anything. They really wouldn't. And awesome. We went back and looked at where we were squadron commanders. That was almost Camelot. My wife called it Camelot. And so there were some great times. And I think my highlight of my career, because I saw Bosnia, I was there when I was with the ARC, when the war was going on, and I saw what the American Army could do when they take the leadership role. And I had Muslim interpreters tell me that they prayed for Americans to say they'd do it because nobody else in the world would. And to see gasoline being sold in Coke bottles, and then to see all of a sudden farmers plowing fields, kids going back to school, people not getting massacred and whatever. The 11 months that I was in Bosnia, that had to be the high point of the 34 years. It really did.
That's amazing. All right, sir. Well, thank you for sharing, basically sharing your life story. You know, your career in the Army was most of your adult life, and phenomenal stories, phenomenal times that you experienced, and just very, very appreciative for sharing all that with us.
Oh, it's been great, and I really I appreciate what you're doing for the foundation. I was a trustee on that organization. Mm-hmm. Great things, and I look forward to seeing you again.
Yeah. All right, thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
Okay.
All right. All right. We are out.
God bless.
Thank you for listening to the Bull Simons Ops Center podcast. The Simons Center is a program of the Command and General Staff College Foundation, a nonprofit that supports scholarship, outreach, and soldier and family support on Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. We operate entirely on the generosity of our donors. To support the Bull Simons Ops Center, go to thesimonscenter.org and click on the donate button. We welcome support at any level.